Well, why don't we pray together? Father, thank you for this opportunity to fellowship together, and we thank you that you're here among us because you've promised to be where your children are gathered. So we especially are conscious of our need for you now in this learning situation because we recognize that ultimately you're our teacher. And so we pray that we would be sensitive to your teaching and help this information that you've helped me to learn to be helpful to my brother and sister. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. Come on in. We're just getting started. Okay. Tell us your name.
Nick.
Hi, Nick. I'm Ralph.
Hi, Ralph.
Andre.
Yeah, my name's
okay. Catalina. Yeah, do you want to pull up a chair? And
yep.
Here. We're just going to do it this way. Is it okay to watch the screen there, or is that a distraction?
No, thanks.
Okay. And if you didn't get notes, I think Gretchen has notes, right? Would you like to have notes? Yeah. Okay. Well, this session is on the subject of leadership, and so it's not particularly related to education, although I function in an educational setting, but it's leadership in the context of an organization. So that's the context that we'll be talking about. And this is really the information that I'm going to share with you is coming from secular sources. So you have to evaluate its validity from a biblical viewpoint. I think that for the most part, it's neutral. In other words, it's principles on which that I think is a helpful tool to assess leadership situations, but there are ways to evaluate this biblically. So let me just say a few words about leadership in general. We could say a lot, but I'll just want to make a couple of observations here. First of all, the people that study leadership, there's this long ongoing debate about what makes a good leader. Is a good leader born? That is a good leader basically a leader, a great leader, or a good leader because they have God's gift to be a leader, or are they made? In other words, do you learn leadership? Well, I think the answer is both, and I think that's even biblically true. Certainly, if you read the Bible very much at all, you have to recognize that leadership is, there is a gift of leadership, and God puts his hand on people for leadership, and he appoints people to leadership, and he gives them enabling to do leadership. So certainly, from a Christian perspective, you have to acknowledge that that's true. But there are secular writers who do not agree that leadership is a gift. They say it's just a skill like anything else. I think it's both. It's sort of like playing the piano. People can learn to play the piano, but some people are musicians and some people are not. And you can learn technically to be proficient in playing the piano. You can even do it pretty well, but you can tell the difference between someone who's greatly gifted and someone who isn't. But another factor about leadership is that it's situational. In other words, there's not just one kind of leader, or there's not just one kind of leadership style that works. All that the studies about leadership have indicated that the best leaders are leaders who either fit into a given situation with their attributes, or they adapt to the situation. So it's a dynamic issue. It's not just here's a leader, here's what a leader is, and you just plug any leader into any situation and they'll be successful. There's a set of dynamics there. You follow me?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So that's one thing to remember, is that leadership is situational, and it involves an interaction between the leader and the context. There's a dynamic going on there. And then, so a good match between the leader's traits and style and the organizational culture and circumstances. I think you could probably get, can you think of an example where you felt like this person was effective as a leader in one setting, and then they moved to another setting, and they were ineffective? Have you seen that? in your work at all? Can you think of a situation? Like a pastor or a
church?
maybe, yes.
Before I was a pastor and I was in engineering, I guess people who would be effective in leadership in the sort of headquarters organization then go out to an engineering site. Different context.
Right. A different kind of leadership is demanded, yeah. And there's actually some pretty sophisticated models of how to match up the various elements in a situation and figure out what the best leadership style is. Again, I think most of the people that have studied this would say there are many things you can learn about adaptation to become more effective in a style. And there's a whole chart. I've got charts and material on that, but that's not the main point today. Go ahead.
So do you think it's an issue of whether the organizational culture and circumstances are inherent to the organization or may in fact bear the imprint of a previous leader?
Oh, could well.
So a new leader comes in with a different style that doesn't fit the mold that's been created by the previous leader.
I don't know if you have this concept in your context, but there's sort of a sacrificial lamb syndrome in the American context, and the syndrome is where a person has been a long-term pastor of a local church, been very successful, and sort of reaches the stage of being an icon, and then that person leaves. It doesn't matter who the next person is coming in, they're the sacrificial lamb, because the church has to get over the first leader and his whole style, and it's very difficult for somebody to follow that kind of a pattern. Yeah, I think that's true. So again, leadership requires a good match between the leadership traits and style and the organizational culture and circumstances. And although leaders have particular traits and what we call default styles, you know what the word default means? Default means let's talk about a computer. A computer has certain default settings. So on this computer, if I don't put a different setting in the computer, it will automatically format things a certain way, So like if I'm working with a document. So it means whatever the system reverts back to, when there's no other influence. So that's what we mean by a default setting in a leader. Every leader has a certain default style. In other words, the basic thing that you instinctively do as a leader to respond to a situation. But one of the key leadership effectiveness traits is to learn to be adaptable and to interact with the context in which you find yourself. And so the more you can learn to recognize what your default style is and then read the clues that are in the leadership situation and adapt your style to the situation, the chances of your being successful as a leader is going to increase. Okay? And just so we can get on the same page in terms of a leader, there's a lot of different definitions of leadership out there. I'm thinking primarily in terms of leadership as influence. And so not necessarily just positions of leadership, but the function of leadership is to influence. So in an organizational setting, obviously a leader influences people to come together around a common purpose and move together. But there is no such thing as leadership if people aren't following. You can be in a leadership position and not be leading, because people are not following. So those are just a few contextual words about leadership. All right, now, what I want to talk to you then about is four frames. And let me explain the concept of frames. The reason I use that term is because that's what the authors use. But let's use the idea of lenses or windows or perspectives. You know that when you look at anything, you were in Dave Patty's session this morning, right? Both of you that was talking about this new model in Czech Republic?
Mm-hmm.
You weren't. But anyway, there are perspectives, sets of lenses through which we look at situations. And the word here is frames. There's a way that you frame a situation. And depending on how you frame that situation, you interpret what you see in that situation on the basis of that frame. You've probably heard the old proverb about the blind man and the elephant. Mm-hmm. you know, depending on where the blind man touches the elephant, he might explain what it is he's touching in many different ways. We're talking about frames. Well, then these writers, Bowman and Deal, which, by the way, I've got the information about them at the end of the paper here, but they have concluded that people tend to operate in organizational environments within one of four basic frames. That is, they view problems, they try to solve problems, they respond to conflict on the basis of a certain frame of looking at the situation. Mm-hmm. And if their frame of looking at the situation doesn't match the frame in which other people that they're interacting with look at the situation, or doesn't match the context of the organization, then it's a very high probability there's going to be conflict and that problems are not going to be solved. So what they've suggested is there's four basic frames that people operate in, that they see problems and solve problems in. The first one is, and these represent really four schools of organizational and management theory. If you were to read all the books there are on leadership and management and all the research and everything, basically they're coming from one of these four perspectives. And Bowman and Deal suggest that ultimately none of those perspectives is the only perspective. And it's helpful to see all the different perspectives and be able to operate, you know, in terms of those four perspectives. It's like being able to, you know, all of you are at least bilingual, right? You speak at least two languages, yes? Well, you know, they say somebody who speaks two languages is bilingual. Somebody who speaks three languages is trilingual. Somebody who speaks one language is an American. So. At any rate, but you understand, because you speak more than one language, that there's a much richer understanding that you have, because you can view things through more than one language. You can say, oh, that's so much more clear in Hungarian than it is in English. Or, you know, you see what I'm saying? Well, this is like, as a leader, instead of just speaking one language, you begin to learn how to speak four languages. And so as a leader, your ability to see problems and interpret them and to solve problems can greatly increase if you learn how to speak other leadership languages, learn how to read them and learn how to speak them. That's kind of what we're talking about here. These are different analytical lenses through which to understand and address organizational dynamics, how organizational tasks, challenges, and problems are viewed, the medium of discourse through which to address a situation and work toward understanding solution. You ever been in a situation where there was a problem or a conflict in an organization and you felt like you were literally talking a different language? That you were trying to explain what the problem was and the person could not understand and you couldn't understand what they were saying? Well, it's possible that the reason is because you were operating from different frames and didn't know it. Yeah, yeah. I have to tell you a joke about that. there was a man walking along the beach, and he accidentally tripped over a bottle, you know, and he reached down and picked it up and shook it off, and a genie popped out of the bottle, you know. And the genie said, oh, thank you for releasing me from this bottle, you know. I'll give you anything you wish, you know, one thing, anything you wish. And the man said, oh, I would love to go to Hawaii. I've never been to Hawaii before. But the problem is that I hate to fly in airplanes. I'm terrified, and I don't like to ride on the ocean either. Could you build me a road to Hawaii? And the genie said, do you have any idea what you're asking? Can you imagine what kind of earth it would take to move to build a road to Hawaii? This is one of the greatest engineering projects of all time. That's ridiculous how difficult that is. Don't you have anything easier? So the man said, well, I'd really like to understand women. You know, what makes them laugh and cry, how they think, you know, how they operate, and so on and so forth. And the genie said, do you want two lanes or four on that road? Two lanes or four lanes on that road. In other words, which is easier? Sorry about that. I'm sure you could tell. You would tell the same story except about men, right? Yes. Now you can go tell your husband that you have a way. So, in other words, the frames represent the medium of discourse through which we address a situation and work toward understanding, or the perceived nature of solutions and the range of solutions that might be available in a given situation. Okay? All right. Now, what are the four frames then? What are they? There are four frames, and I'll try to unpack them for you. There's some notes there for you. But the first frame is what's called the structural frame. The second one is called the human resource frame. The third frame is called the political frame. And the fourth frame is called the symbolic frame. Okay? And I'll try to explain what each one of those means. But those are the four frames. Structural, human resource, political, and symbolic. Okay, so let's take them one at a time. The structural frame basically views the organization as a complex machine. Okay, the organization is a machine. You put everything in the right order. You get everything working smoothly, and so on and so forth. That's the way an organization works. The organizational perspective is that the organization exists to attain certain goals. And there are very efficient ways to achieve goals, aren't there? It's sort of scientific, right? You just put everything in the right order and the goals will be achieved and everything works well. And so you structure everything to optimize the fit among the environment and the technology and the participants in the situation. You just get, you know, so if there's a problem, what's the solution to the problem? Better organization. Get it functioning right. Something's out of place. You need to reorganize. You need to restructure. You need a new policy. You need a new procedure. You need to create a new form. Everything can be solved by some kind of a problem. Well, and so when there is turbulence in the environment, you know what turbulence is, right? The way to keep that from the environment from being turbulent is to set policies and norms. You know, if everybody will just conform to these policies or whatever, that will solve the problem. See? Problems then, the assessment of problems is this is an inappropriate structure. We need to work on the structure. When you see a problem, you immediately say, the problem with this is that the structure is wrong. It doesn't function well. We need a new structure. We need a new policy. We need a new... And I see you nodding, so you must know somebody who operates in the structural frame, yes? So the fix for a problem is, how do you fix the problem? You redesign or you restructure the organization. Well, is that a useful frame? Sure, often. Often it is. I mean, some problems really are structural. Some situations really do need to be better organized. Some organizations really can be improved by a better focus on goals. Some operations really can be improved by better policies and by people conforming to more consistent standards and processes and so on and so forth. By the way, I can tell right now, structural is not your frame. When we get through them, I'm going to ask you if you can recognize your frame, okay? So just be thinking about that as we go through. Which frame is the one that you operate in, okay? Okay, let's look at the human resource frame. The image is the extended family. Organizations are not machines. They're organisms, you know, and they're webs of relationships. And the important thing in an organization is for people to relate well to one another. I don't know if you were in the session the other day with Eric Zander. He's from Belgium. He runs a mission organization, and he was talking about the significant improvement that happened in their organization when they took their focus off strictly on the objectives of the organization and started focusing on the people and recognized that people were their greatest resource, and they needed to subordinate their concern about goal achievement and structure and all this kind of stuff to the concern for people. And it's been a big improvement in their organization. Well, the image then is the extended family. So what's the organizational perspective? The organization exists to serve the needs of the members. Again, these are not mutually exclusive, but this is the tendency that you sort of move toward if you view things in this frame. Why does this organization exist? Well, because the members have their own needs, and they need to be nurtured. They need to be fed. By the way, is this a good frame? Is this a useful frame for viewing the church?
I was thinking to ask if the increase one of these
Well, I would say some of all, probably, but this is probably closer to the organic. The organic nature of the church is a web of relationships.
And so you don't determine needs.
Yeah, right. But if the church is going to get anywhere, and all you've got is human relations people, you're going to be in trouble because nobody will have any goals. So, okay, okay. So the organization exists to serve human needs. There's a poor fit between the individual and the organization. Signals that there's exploitation involved. In other words, when somebody's uncomfortable in this kind of environment, then the interpretation of that is, oh, the organization is exploiting them, or they're exploiting the organization. There's basically a mutual benefit is viewed from a good fit. When these things fit together, there's mutual benefit. So how are problems viewed? How would you anticipate? Of course, it's in your notes there, but how are problems viewed? Well, when we have a problem in this organization, if we view it through the human relations thing, oh, the problem is there's a relational problem. You know, this is not about ideas. This is not about structure. This is about relationships, you know. And so that's what the real problem is, and we've got to resolve the problem with the relationship, and everything will be all right. See, that's the way the human relations frame views things. And then the fix is to train people better or to develop the organization, to develop the people in the organization, to work together, to grow together. Those are the kind of fixes that tend to be viewed in the human relations frame, okay? I'm gonna get these all before you, and then we can explore them a little bit. In fact, at the end, I've got some case studies for us to talk about. Mm-hmm. The political frame, the image is the jungle. And in other words, what's the law of the jungle? Yeah, the strong survive. The might, you know, whoever has the most power wins. The organizational perspective is decisions involve the allocation of scarce resources. By the way, this is very, very predominant in educational institutions. There's not enough resources to go around. If my department's going to get what it needs, I'm going to have to fight for it. You know, we're going to have to mobilize power and so on. There's competing. Everything about life is competition. The political person sees everything about life as a competition. Everything's competing with one another. It's like a battle. Somebody's got to win. Somebody's got to lose. Too bad everybody else has to lose, but we're going to win. And since we're right anyway, we might as well win. Everybody else is the enemy. You know, we've got to win. Success, then, in an organization like this is achieved through coalitions, bargaining, negotiation, and jockeying for position. The way you operate, the way you get things done in the organization is you build coalitions. You get people together and say, we got to do something about this. You know, let's get a coalition together and go talk to the boss or go, you know. And anybody who's ever been a pastor of a church that has a political culture understands what this is like. You're nodding because you've at least probably observed this, right? Yeah. Okay, Nick. Yeah. Yeah, okay. By the way, it's arguable that this is probably the most unbiblical or worldly frame, if you will, but it is a frame that actually exists out there. So, and again, the person who operates out of a political frame just says, hey, conflict is a fact of life. There is such a thing as good and bad. There is such a thing as right and wrong. There is such a thing as enemies. And I've got to fight against these enemies. You know, these are not benign things. These are real enemies that I've got to fight against. And since they're enemies, then I have the right to you know, mobilize and fight and so on. So then problems in the political frame, the assessment of problems is that conflict, the way to resolve conflict is to do what? Can you think of a word that would be appropriate for the political frame? What's the resolution of conflict in the political frame?
Doing a deal.
Okay. Well, that'd be one. Doing, making a deal, cutting a deal. Yeah. How about winning? Yeah. In the political frame, the way you deal with conflict is somebody wins. Well, and then the fix in a political frame, the way you want to pursue a solution in this frame is to build a base of power or exercise power. If you're in a position of power, you put the screws to people. You say, get in line, you know, do this or else. I'm gonna wield my power over you, and I'm gonna push you around and so on. And I can do that because I'm in a position of authority and I'm right anyway, and anybody who opposes me is probably my enemy and wrong. So I'm giving you the extreme view of it, but it's a frame. It's a frame, okay? Now, the most difficult one is the symbolic frame. I got to hurry here. But the image here is the theater or the temple. And basically, the organizational perspective is that everything the organization does is loaded with meaning. And the organization, the effectiveness of the organization is to capture the meaning in everything that's done. It's interesting that if you look at the Old Testament and you look at the leadership in the Old Testament, you see some of this frame. For example, what did the Israelites do over and over again when there was a significant event in their lives? They set up symbols, right? You know, what happened to Jacob when he wrestled with the angel or whatever? He called the place Bethel and so on, and he made a symbol about it and so on. When they crossed the Jordan, they set up 12 stones and so on. So symbolic is certainly has some biblical warrant, the idea that organizations need to have markers of meaning. And so the activities of the organization aren't just significant in and of themselves, but they're significant for what they symbolize. So the fact that we, for example, let's say that we have a prayer meeting on Tuesday morning, it's not just that we have this prayer meeting, but the symbolism of our dependence on God and so on and so forth. And it's loaded with meaning, or that we have chapel services at school, that's loaded with meaning. And leaders who operate in the symbolic frame are constantly trying to elevate the meaning of various things. They're trying to get rituals in place and establish traditions and so on and so forth. So myths and stories and rituals and metaphors serve to provide a sense of direction, increase clarity, resolve confusion. I remember just to give you one illustration, the school that I belong to is one of the hallmarks of the school is the message of surrender and trust as the way to victory in Christ, to really walking with the Lord. Surrender and trust, or trust and obey, so on and so forth. Well, the original building at the school happened to have two towers, okay? And they call those towers surrender and trust, okay? And the yearbook of the college is called the finial, which finial is the crowning ornament on a tower. And that's the name of the yearbook. Well, it was the campus that they lived, that they operated on for 30 years was too small. It was downtown, and they moved to another huge campus off, you know, outside the city. But the buildings on the campus didn't have any towers. And you would be amazed how many people were just scandalized by the fact that those towers were gone, and how much they worked to try to get that there because they saw the significance of those symbols. Okay, that's just an example of the symbolic frame. Okay, I see that you're sort of the lights are going on here, and you're recognizing this. Okay, so then problems is if there's a problem, the problem is because we haven't developed a strong enough organizational culture, and people don't really see the meaning of what we're doing. So we have to create symbols. We have to create traditions. We have to preserve traditions. Not because the traditions in and of themselves or anything, but because they're what keeps the organization on target and keeps the meaning there. You know, it'd be like having the navigators without the wheel or having the navigators without the bridge. They're so woven into the fabric of the identity of the navigators that it would be hard to separate them. So the fix then of problems is to recognize the importance of perceived meaning, change the picture without smashing the symbol. So how do you perpetuate the meaning while you change the picture a little bit? Okay.
Excuse me. last point. Could you repeat this about fixing the problem?
Okay. Well, a person in the symbolic frame that wants to improve the organization looks for a way to change the picture without smashing the symbol. So, for example, let me give you a negative example. Let's go back to the towers at our campus.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose the president had come in there and they were building the new campus, and he said, you know, it's about time we got rid of those stupid towers. I'm so glad we're moving to a new campus because we don't have to deal with those dumb towers. You know, that's ridiculous to think that those have any meaning. You know, the message is still there. The towers don't mean anything. Well, a wiser thing to do might have been to think of some other symbol for the message of surrender and trust. And to say, oh, there are many other things that symbolize that. Let's produce another symbol. Let's talk about another metaphor that works so that you affirm what the symbol means without necessarily perpetuating the symbol. You follow me? Okay. There's combinations, and I'm just going to run through these real quick. I'm not going to spend any time on this because I want us to have time to explore this. By the way, these are abbreviations I think you can figure out. Structural plus human relations is a system person with a heart. Human relations and symbolic is an organizational teddy bear, somebody that's real soft-hearted and so on. That's in your notes. You can think about that some more. So what? Well, the value or appropriateness of these frames is only significant in terms of how they correspond to the setting. There's not necessarily one frame that's right or wrong, good or bad. I think all of these can be critiqued biblically, and all of them are more or less aligned with biblical principles. But now we're talking pragmatically in terms of what exists out there. It's a set of tools from which to view organizations and to analyze situations. So the frames are valuable and significant primarily as an analytical tool to say, what is the frame in which this organization is operating or in which this person that I'm having a disagreement with is coming from? You know, we have this saying in English, I can't tell where you're coming from. I don't understand where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's another way of saying we must not be operating in the same frame here. Or it sounds like we're speaking a different language. Well, the truth is you probably are in terms of this kind of thing. Frames are about how people work with each other, and so it's important to recognize these frames. And then leaders generally have a default and a secondary frame. In other words, there's one of these frames that probably most closely describes the way you intuitively view a situation and want to respond to the situation. Now, I'm going to put you on the spot. Have you been able to recognize for yourselves what your default frame is, as we've talked about this? Okay, human resource person. Yeah. Yeah. You're a human resource.
The same.
Really? Wow, that's 3 for 3. Well, what about you, Nick? Have you figured anything out yet?
I can't make up my mind between structural and human resource.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I can't work out whether I'm prejudiced against structural by previous experience in engineering.
Uh-huh.
Biased towards human resource,
yeah,
having to be a pacifist.
Yeah. Ah, very good. By the way, again, one of the implications of this is a leader needs to be adaptable in terms of the frame depending on the setting in which they're working. Now, see, what I work in an organizational setting, okay, and my job is administrative. So what do you suppose my default frame is?
Structural.
Yeah, structural. And that's why I do well in that setting, because it fits well with my default frame. What kind of person do you think I clash with the most? Actually, political. Yeah. I cannot stand politics. For one thing, it's what's wrong with educational institutions is politics. And probably the worst conflict I've ever had in my whole ministry that was just really grieved. I wish I knew then what I know now about these frames, because the person, it was like I could not communicate with the person. And he was just frustrated as I was, but he was political. Every problem, the way he confronted the problem was to see me as the enemy and to do everything he could to try to muster political power against what I was trying to do. And I'm saying, wait a minute, can't we just sit down here and reason about this? You know?
But that's interesting because I mean, just met you, but I would have thought somebody who was working in a structural frame, that somebody who had human resources and was kind of all over the place involved with people would frustrate you.
Right.
But it doesn't frustrate you as much because hearing what your view and philosophy of life and ministry is, that that's somewhere where you're heading your structure. So actually it depends also on what your belief is.
I think everybody's just a different combination. I think I'm probably primarily structural and secondarily human resources. And so, are we running out of time?
No.
Oh, okay. You were going to make a comment?
Yeah, well, I was going to ask a question.
Okay, go ahead. So, you can come up here and join us. You don't have to sit way back there.
So,
this is Gretchen, everybody. What these authors tell you is the only way to deal with political opposition is politically. You have to deal with it from a position of power. You have to deal with it with the tools of political power. In my opinion, I think an awful lot of political mindset is really unbiblical. And I think that's one reason why I react so strongly against it. It seems so hostile to biblical values. Matthew 20. The kings of the Gentiles, what? They lord it over one another. They wield power and authority and so on. And so when I see that, I just immediately seize up and get mad, you know, and say. But in this, you know, it's a long story. But in this situation, I should have insisted on the authority that went with my position. Instead of trying to reason with the person, I'd say, you know, I'm in charge here. You know, you're just going to have to submit to it because I'm in charge. This is my responsibility. That's the only way you can deal with political opposition, if they won't reason with you. In other words, if they won't change frames and get into another frame, then you can only deal with it that way. Well, okay, so what? Effective leaders develop the capacity to perceive and communicate within the frame most appropriate to the organizational culture and circumstances. In other words, if you want to be a more effective leader, learn how to recognize frames. Learn how to recognize what the culture is telling you about the frame in which it operates, or learn how to recognize what the frame is for the people with whom you're interacting about a given problem. So if Andre comes to me and there's an issue, there's a problem that needs to be resolved in our working together, it helps me to know that he sees problems as basically relational, and he perceives solutions as strengthening relations, as developing people, and this kind of thing. And if I'm sitting over here not responding on his terms and not at least seeing the problem from his perspective, then the chances of us finding a solution are very remote. Because I'm going to be trying to say, that is not the problem. The problem is we need another policy. Can't you see that? And then, you know, the temperature goes up, we start shouting at one another, and then we've got a big problem. And the problem is, the thing is that we both acknowledge there's a problem. Now the question is, can we see what the dynamics of the problem are? And if we can talk about the problem, even using these frames and saying, well, viewing it from this perspective, this is what the problem is. Viewing it from this perspective, this is what the problem is. Now let's talk about a solution. Let's try to work that out. So, and I would say also, every organization has a culture. And the culture of that organization is likely to be similar to one of these frames. So, going back to the church situation or whatever, every church probably has a culture. And if you walk in there as a pastor or whatever, and your default frame is structural, and the culture of the church is symbolic, you're in for big trouble. You're going to be having explosions every time you turn around because you're going to keep destroying symbols that mean a lot to everybody in the church. And you think, what is the matter with these people? Aren't they, you know, why can't they understand this means nothing? Well, it means nothing to you, but it means everything to them. And so,
can you look at like worship as symbols, like songs?
Oh, yeah. That's a symbolic issue, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
We want the songs and then.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter what you sing, you just sing to God.
Right. And of course, there is a.
Or go away with the singing at all, let's make barbecue.
Yeah, that's a human relations guy there, see.
Yeah,
see. So, now you're getting it. You're catching on here. Okay, so successfully...
Yeah, I am the elder who's proposing this kind of stuff.
There you go. And now you know why people are resisting it.
Some of them.
Yeah, there are some people resisting it is because they operate from a different frame. Okay, successfully understanding and resolving problems occurs when the fix frame matches the problem frame. If this really is a structural problem, then the only way to fix it is structural. But if you're a structural person and you only tend to read problems as structural, if the problem is not structural, it's really a human relations problem, then no amount of effort to try to fix this thing structurally is going to work. So... You have to be able to say, what really is this? What kind of a problem is this? Is this a human relations problem? Is it a political problem? Is it a symbolic problem? Is it a structural problem? Just because I tend to, by default, think of things certain ways, it might help me to think, wait a minute, am I using the right set of glasses? Am I talking in the right language? Am I using the right set of lenses? And if I do, then it might be revolutionary in terms of an ability to solve the problem. Go ahead, Garth.
I was thinking, how many of these problems actually come out to interpersonal problems?
There's sin involved, isn't there?
Yeah.
And so it's more complicated than just simple frames, obviously. There is such a thing as people being wrong and sinful. So this is only a tool that you can use. Yeah. Okay, I'm not going to go over all this, but this is a chart that they came up with. Yeah.
The resolving the problem occurs when the fixed frame matches the problem frame.
Mm-hmm.
What if the problem is actually a structural one, and you see that as a leader, but everyone else in the organization sees it as a human resource?
Well, I think you're going to have to work hard to recognize how to define the problem in their terms and show them how the structure is going to improve the human relations environment or something.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And of course, you're going to have to go over time. You know, what tends to happen is that when people don't see things our way, we dig in and resist. Rather than saying, let me look at it your way for a while. Let me look at it with you for a while, this way. Now, how about, would you look at it this way with me for a while? Now, what do you think? You know, which is going to give us a clearer picture of what's wrong here? Well, now you've moved into a human relations mode by saying, let me look at it your way for a while. See? Okay. I'm not going to go over this. This is just some stuff that that's more detail on that situation. But let's try this out.
My question is concerning problems.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that the nature of the problems is a very subjective thing, or they are objectively symbolic or relational?
Very good question.
Mm-hmm. Or we just have our points of views and, you know, how to go out from this jungle
with
different points of views to solve the problem.
I'd want to think about that a little bit more, but my immediate answer is probably some are subjective. That is, they really are just different points of view. Others of them are really right and wrong issues.
Okay.
There really is a right way to look at this problem and a wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, there's a good way and a better way to look at problems.
Okay.
So I think it depends on the situation, and there's where you have to exercise some biblical discernment. You know, Lord, is this something that we have a way of saying in English, you know, do I want to die on this hill? You know, is this something I want to lay my life down for, or is this something that's really not, in the end, in the big picture, that important? It's not a biblical issue. It's not an issue of right or wrong. This is an issue of working together and resolving problems and moving on. That takes a lot of discernment, and only the, and this doesn't provide the discernment. It just provides you some tools that might help you to increase your ability to discern in situations. Okay, let's talk about this situation for a minute. We sort of alluded to this earlier. This actually happens in the States. I don't know if you have, you know, to what extent this is even relevant to you, but you know, there's a midweek service in the church that's been there for years. We've always had a midweek service. We've always had one. The pastoral is a structural, his default frame is structural and secondarily human resources, okay? And the church members are symbolic and political, okay? That's their frames. Now, the pastor comes along and he goes to the church deacon's meeting or elders meeting and he says, you know what? This Wednesday service just isn't working. Nobody's coming. You know, we have 1,000 people on Sunday and we've got 20 people on Wednesday. We need to stop doing this. That's a very typically structural way to answer the problem, right? It doesn't work. Let's do something else, right? What do you think the likelihood of that being a popular proposal from the pastor when the church is symbolic and political? How do you anticipate the church members are going to respond? Okay, and what are they going to interpret that as on the part of the pastor? The pastor is against what? He doesn't believe in what? Prayer, right? I mean, it's a prayer service, right? The pastor doesn't believe in prayer because this service symbolizes our commitment to prayer as a congregation. Never mind that we don't actually pray, you know, but this symbolizes our commitment to prayer. If we do away with that, then it means we don't care about prayer anymore. Well, so the pastor better be very careful about how he introduces that subject and about the solutions that he proposes. In other words, first of all, he needs to recognize the culture in the church and say, you know, this church culture is pretty symbolic. It's very highly symbolic. So I need to recognize that little ideas that don't mean anything to me might mean a great deal to them. They might signify something to them that they don't signify to me, because I'm not hung up on the symbols. You follow me? You see what I'm saying? Give me an example. You were starting to give me an example in your church situation that's similar to that.
Yes, I think our pastor is structural. Mm-hmm. He was an engineer before. And he has all responsibilities are written down into the last details.
Uh-huh.
And has to be done so and so.
Yeah.
How you can really get people work, right, or do something, or how things go, you know, mm-hmm, like messages from one person, mm-hmm, to the other. And he just doesn't see that, mm-hmm, that things are moving behind him because he, mm-hmm, doesn't recognize it.
Right. And so if the church is not doing well, how is the pastor likely to interpret the problem?
That we have to write down even more strongly.
Right.
And definitions and papers handing out, and we get a letter.
Right.
Which nobody reads.
Right.
And then we vote, but we don't read the letters, and then he shows the letters that's what you vote.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, but that's not what we meant.
Because you had to respond from within what? His frame, right?
Yeah.
And so he framed the issue this way and gave you options that were only valid within that frame. If he would have given you other options.
If he would have talked to us or meet things.
Uh-huh.
We have elderly ladies who have older songs and they don't like this new kind of
uh-huh,
songs.
Yeah.
And for them, we have two of these ladies who are still members of our church,
mm-hmm,
100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And all the new members come from the transition from 1990,
mm-hmm,
who came from a university group,
mm-hmm,
like the absolute opposite
style. Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's not his vision.
Mm-hmm.
We should have another worship. But for these ladies, that's the
right
church.
Right. And what the pastor is doing is just absolutely smashing all these symbols that so he's really, in their minds, he's basically trashing the history of the church.
He's ignoring the traditions,
yeah.
And ignoring them.
Right.
and
right.
roots. And
right.
so they should live, and it's another church now.
Right.
Now, not their church.
Right.
And I think we kind of compromised. It was that we had a rule saying that every worship has to have one old song, and it was structured.
Yeah, right. So it's a compromise. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it didn't. It probably hasn't resolved the situation very well at all. It's just nobody's happy now. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's a nature of a compromise.
Right.
Nobody is satisfied.
Right.
With it. Yeah. But what to do in such situation? Yeah.
It takes real. Yeah. It takes real discernment.
Kind of
yeah.
This kind of problem.
Yeah. Well, again, I think it involves affirming the meaning of the symbol, and then getting people to. Confronting people with the fact that the symbol, that what the symbol is meant to symbolize really isn't working anymore. And to say, can you help us think of another way to affirm this, which is so important? I'm not saying, you know, in an ideal world, everybody would finally come to reconciliation and resolution. In the real world, that doesn't happen as often. But one reason why it happens less than it could is because we operate from different frames and we don't see it. And so if we can train ourselves to see different ways of viewing problems and so on, at least we have a clue as to why we're running into difficulty. And we may have some cool... I'm sorry?
If we knew that it was a symbol, you know, it was just there existing on
there. Right, right. So it takes a lot of wisdom then to figure out how to affirm symbols and create traditions that mean things and so on. Well, let's take another one. Here's an organizational budget meeting. The leader is structural and symbolic, and the members are political. What would that look like? What's the dynamics of the political situation? What's one of the main premises of the political situation? Uh-huh. Well, first of all, the main premise is that resources are scarce and not everybody's going to get their share. So the way to make sure you get your share is to do what?
Get the leader on your side.
Yeah, uh-huh. Try to organize for it. And here's the poor leader saying, we can work this out, yeah. And furthermore, sees that the amount of money that's allocated in certain areas of the budget, symbolic people would say... this represents our commitment to
mm-hmm.
this and so. See, it's not just that this is the budget. This budget represents something. This represents our commitment to evangelism, or it represents our commitment to worship. Well, there's a certain amount of truth in that, isn't it? In fact, somebody once said that a budget is the most profound philosophical statement that any organization makes. But so there is some validity to that, but... This is the cause of a lot of conflict in meetings. Let's get another one here in an organization. Suppose you're in a position of responsibility or authority, and you've got a colleague who's underperforming. And the leader in the organization is a human relations and symbolic person, and the colleagues in the organization are structural and political. Right. Very good. And the leader's instinct would be to say, well, we just got to give them more time. And we can't, you know, we don't want to be thought of as an organization that's rough on people, because that symbol, you know, to fire somebody symbolizes our commitment to people. That's what it means, you know. We're not really a caring organization if we fire somebody. That's what, see, a symbolic person would view it that way. But the colleagues here are structural and political, so what's going to happen? Yeah, and they're willing to do what to get them out? Organize, you know, go. Five of them go to the boss and say, you got to do something about this. That can be pretty messy, and it happens. It happens. So what I'm seeing is that you're starting to be able to figure out the dynamics here. So that's, there's another one in a school setting. Students are dissatisfied with their teacher. Student A is a human relations person. Student B is a structural person. Student C is a political person. how are they going to respond to that situation? If you're unhappy with your teacher and you're a human relations person, what are you going to do? Huh?
Maybe nothing.
Maybe nothing, but if anything, what are you going to do?
Try to give ideas how he could be better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the base of a what?
Of a, the others who are not.
Well, okay. I'm thinking from the base of a relationship. In other words, you might want to establish a relationship with the teacher and then from the base of that relationship try to, you know, give some ideas and so on. Yeah. I'm sorry?
Yeah, to give clues and yeah. Make sure that I accept you and
yes.
I like you
right.
And I'm helping you.
Right. It's not, in other words, it's not you as a person that I'm criticizing. It's this thing. Yeah. Okay. Student B is going to do what?
Make a clear policy. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
We want to make sure we do regular course evaluations and that they're
right.
Anonymous and, you know, and,
right.
Okay. Now, what about student C?
I know much, much better teacher who is looking for a job right now.
Well, that would be an extreme. Yeah, that's good. Well, at the very least, what they might want to do is they would go to the student council. And if there weren't a student council, they'd say, let's create one because we need to have a what? We need to have a voice. And furthermore, we want the student council to have a say about evaluating teachers. Now, all those things are maybe useful in a situation, but the way people respond to a situation is probably in terms of the frame they operate in. And again, depending on the situation, that may or may not be a useful strategy, see? That's the source from which the basic article comes, Bowman and Deal. And I think that, do I have that in your notes, I think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also the website where you can, that's actually, you can download that off the web, the whole article if you want. We've got about 5 minutes before I need to turn it over to Gretchen. No, I need to give it over to her pretty soon. But are there any questions or, yeah?
Let's say in the leadership, what is good when there's a leadership of four people, if, you know, whether they have all different frames, so they have to fight their fights within the leadership, or they are in one frame and then they have to fight with the community.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, okay. All right, well, we'll keep going a few more minutes. Anybody want to?
I just have a question. Maybe it's the same question. If you're drawing a team together, do you want somebody from each of these frames to be on that team in an ideal world?
I think, you know, my biblical values would say, what do you guys think? Let me stop and ask what you think. I'm sorry?
I don't want a political leader in my church leadership team.
Uh-huh. Yeah, good. Yeah, my instinct would be that if you build a leadership team, you should look for diversity deliberately so. And by the way, that's harder, but it's better. It's much easier to work intuitively with people who think exactly like you do. You don't have arguments. You immediately recognize what the problem is. You immediately know what the solution is. But then it doesn't work as well. Right.
That must be God's way, and that's good. And why aren't the others obeying?
Right, right.
Nick, I was kind of interested because my thought was to learn all of them as well, apart from the political. But then I keep on seeing this through the gauze of sin.
Uh-huh.
But when you shared the last case study where the student political goes to the student body or
right.
Says, well, that's actually a good idea. Yeah. If you're talking about a gracious person,
right.
My experience of political people is
right.
They're so often not gracious.
Right.
Say you had a political person who was really gracious and godly, lover of people, would you be happier then?
Right.
routine.
It's very heavily sanctified.
Well, let me give you an example. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Nick. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that having the somebody who has repented of having a physical friend. so they can recognize it.
Yeah.
But I'm not constrained to operate that way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think obviously you want people that are teachable and that have the basic attribute of wanting to affirm and acknowledge other people's perspectives. Those are all traits that you want in any leader. Let me give you an example of something that's going on in our institution right now. We had, and it's very complex, but I'll just take a minute to tell you. Our alumni ministry is an important ministry for our school. You know, it's very important for us to continue to stay in contact with our alumni, to encourage them, to minister to them. Well, we've just had an abysmal record in that area. We've had a series of leaders that have been ineffective, especially in terms of the structural side of things. They've been nice human relations people that were good at building personal relationships, but terrible at organizing structures where you're dealing with 14,000 alumni from a school like ours. Well, we finally, just in the last few months, I had to go to the incumbent alumni director and say, you know what, brother, this is not a fit. You know, you need to be looking for other work. This is not going to work. I should back up and say, our last homecoming, at which there was a business meeting of alumni, the frustration, I mean, they know the frustration, so it sort of boiled over. And one of the alumni got up and made a huge proposal. Let's turn the alumni association independent of the school. We need to be an independent enemy. Let me get my dentures back in place. An independent entity. I mean, and we'll buy the alumni center from the school, but we don't trust the administration to really do the right thing for the alumni and this kind of thing and so forth. And he made this big proposal right out in the business meeting, right out of the blue. He just stood up and made this proposal, said, let's, you know, I want to form a corporation. Let's do all this kind of stuff. Well, what was that an example of? That's a person who operates in what mode?
Political.
Yeah. But one of the mistakes you make, I think, if you're a structural or human relations person, is to squelch political initiative rather than to channel it. And reasonable people, their political initiatives can be channeled. So the way to do that, we just said, wait a minute, if things are this bad, people are frustrated. We need to give this a voice. Now let's provide a context in which. So we said, okay, we're going to have an alumni summit. And when I get back to Columbia next week, we've invited 25 people, including this guy who was the big mouth, to a meeting. We said, we're going to sit down for a couple hours and we're going to say, hey, what's the problem here? We're all on the same team. We're all on the same side. We all want this to work. We believe it's a good thing. Now let's figure out what the problem is. How do we see the problem? How do we go forward from here? What kind of leadership do we need? And so on and so forth. So he came about it in a political mode, and my immediate reaction, and my reaction, because I'm a little bit human relations, was a little bit more kinder than some, but some people were really mad, you know, and just wanted to go, you know, tell this guy he was dismissed from the alumni association kind of thing, you know, just excommunicate him. But instead, giving him a place in which to exercise his influence actually helps. So going back to the student situation, that's what made me think of it, Garth. There are inappropriate ways for students to organize and lobby and try to change things in a situation or in a church, for example. There are inappropriate ways. But there are ways for leaders to provide structures for that kind of a voice to happen that can actually be very constructive. And can diminish then the tendency for people to go around in political power. And so you have to, your immediate tendency is to just lock up and say, I'm going to resist that, you know, I'm going to resist that head on. But if you give it a voice, sometimes you can help it. Okay, any other questions, concerns, discussion, ideas?
I have, yes. Yeah. Just very quickly, a couple of things. One is an example, which I think shows these differences quite well, is we have a church building that has quite a small car park, and the road gets very clogged up with cars, and there's all these church members coming in park, and it's difficult. And there's one guy that's opposite the church building who tends to use the church car park one or two cars in there. And you have some people who have a structural attitude to this: we need the space in the car park, and the solution, we'll put a chain across, chain gets broken down. You've got those who, for whom this is a very passionate issue because it's a symbolic thing about our car park. We've got primarily as a church leadership, we're concerned about relationship with the neighbours, so we don't want people making a fuss about it. What's the big deal? You know, just park further the road and walk. But we try to deal with the political element by, rather than sort of allowing this to blow up and around the church meeting, to actually have a say, let's, anyone who's got a view on this issue can join a group with one of the elders to work this through.
Right, so you've channeled the political. Yeah, that's good.
But so that just struck me as one that sort of clearly shows four different responses to it. But another one was, we have a missionary who's in Brazil, and he's been there about 4 years, so I'm not sure how accurate his assessment is, but his assessment is that in Brazil, all problems seem to be viewed in relationship terms.
Yeah, oh yeah. That, by the way, this is very culturally, this varies quite a bit with cultures. There are certain cultures where the default frame commonly is one or the other. Americans, you could imagine that most Americans are what?
Structural,
of course. We think the solution to every problem is a better plan.
But
which is why American missionaries run into problems sometimes.
I just wonder how, but one particular way that comes out is over theological issues. The issues of theological principle and conflict between theological position are often not seen.
Yeah.
So everything's seen in relationship terms. So there's a seminary, say, with 100 people on the faculty, and you've got sort of three conservative evangelicals, and you've got everybody else, and you've got the Barthians, and you've got completely conflicting theological positions being taught in neighbouring rooms. But it's just, everyone would say there's, well, there's problems in the relationships in the faculty.
Yeah.
But I was just wondering, if we would say, well, actually there's a real issue about theology, which frame does that fit into?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I know enough about the dynamics of the situation, where the authority structures are, who owns the seminary, and so on and so forth. There comes a time when you have to set some parameters, and depending on the authority you have in the situation, you may have to make some things. So I wouldn't know enough about that situation to be able to give you much insight, but it is interesting to view it from the standpoint of the different frames that people are coming from.
Yeah.
And to realize that things that seem self-evident to you are not nearly as self-evident to people who view things from a different frame. What else?
Good question. One quick comment, though. I wish I'd heard what you were saying 2 years ago when I was on a team where we really got it wrong together. And I was part of the problem. And the thing is, we're all really good friends still. And you think it was sin. It wasn't. It was these guys working different frames, and I didn't listen. And if God's kind of got it through my thick head, but I just think, it's a lesson, and I can see it, as you imagine, many other times with other people where that's happened. One of the things, though, if you have a team where you have your ideal situation with godly people who have these different frames, do you think? And this is maybe off the subject a little bit. I'm just coming to experience.
That's fine. That's fine.
Do you mind? Because I'm quite interested in this. Do you think you should have someone who leads in that team? Okay, it's a team of people, or do you think the team should lead? Any experience of things like that? That's some issue I've got. At least three situations I'm in just now, and one with myself.
I can't get away from the fact that the Bible tends to go towards leaders. In other words, leaders seem to be part of God's plan. I think people get the wrong view of they look at the Old Testament, for example, and they see Moses go up to Mount Sinai and get God's word and come down and tell the people. I'm not sure that that's very valid for our time. But I think in general, God works through leaders. On the other hand, I think the New Testament pattern in particular, I can make an argument, it's the biblical pattern of leadership. When there is no direct revelation, you know, like in the Old Testament, you've got Moses talking directly to God and there's direct revelation going on there. But now you don't have direct revelation. You've been given the revelation of Scripture and so on. So it's a different dynamic. The Holy Spirit lives in all believers and so on. There's a number of principles which we could elaborate on for a long time, but I think in general, even though there's a leader, where possible, that leader should be working to build consensus, and that leader should be working to release the perspectives of all the people in the group and release the gifts of all the people in the group, and a lot of leadership situations fail to do that.
Yeah, I think a team of leaders.
Right.
So you would still say that even though this leader may lead from behind, maybe a servant leader, he still leads his team of leaders, that your view would be that kind of person is probably necessary.
Probably. Well, even this is an interesting thing to think about. What is the most absolutely perfect, impeccable relationship in the universe?
The
Trinity. Is there any leadership structure in the Trinity?
Well, the Son submits to the Father, and the Holy Spirit draws, illuminates Jesus Christ.
Right. So what you've got there is you've got, you know, here's theology. What does the theology say about Father, Son, and Holy Spirit? Same in substance, equal in power and glory. So, in other words, is the role that Father, Son, and Holy Spirit take in the Trinity reflective of their relative position, power, or whatever? No, they're all, each one of them is infinitely powerful, infinitely loving, infinitely. So why do they have roles then? Well, because they have something they want to do. I say they, and that, you know, to even say they is sort of heresy, but you understand what I'm saying. So I think anytime you have more than one individual, then there has to be some structure to the relationship in order to get anything done. And what makes that work is submission, not leadership. Obviously, a leader is only a leader, why? Because people, what? Follow. So, okay, we need to do the evaluation, but let's keep talking.
There's a very big comment, the idea of eldership in the New Testament.
Right. Plurality, I think, is a biblical concept. Yeah. Well, that's not mine. I don't know who's that. Oh, that's yours?
No.
Whose watch? Oh, maybe so. Hey, let me see if it's any better than mine.
I'm part of an eldership team. And we work hard at a real plurality of elders and parity of elders. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's dangers in, if you have somebody, I'm not called, I'm there only full-time. Mm-hmm. I'm not called the pastor, though. Mm-hmm. If you have one who is called the pastor, then the danger is that you lose real parity.
Yes. Yeah.
If you, the danger of emphasizing parity is that a leadership can be a bit directionless. Mm-hmm. Because somebody's got to put an idea in and say, let's think about going this way. So there has to be somebody, I think, at any point in time within the team who sees themselves as bearing responsibility for initiative.
Yeah, this I've heard this stated in the realm of governing boards. Okay, there's a lot of literature on nonprofit governing boards, and one of the things that this literature says is the chairman of the board should be the person who's the best facilitator of group process.
Yeah.
Okay, And so, in other words, they're chairman not because they're more brilliant than everybody else, or not because they're, you know, the most experienced, or you don't just rotate it because, you know, everybody needs to have a turn or whatever. There are some people that are gifted. God has blessed and gifted them as facilitators of group process. And I think that's a good principle in a leadership situation. What leader, what person in this group, if you are coming together as more or less peers, which one of us is really the best at facilitating group process, getting all of us to work together, helping us to think, helping us to move ahead? You know, some people, you've been in meetings where the poor person who was the leader of the meeting was hopeless in terms of moving anything along and getting anything done. But they might be the high status person, see, and then, you know, you've got all kinds of problems. Yeah.
The oldest person.
Right.
They were putting jobs in.
Right.
And it was actually fascinating because we say that we're all men and women, but it was the female person in the team who was clearly the best.
Right, right. And that's very hard for people to come to terms with sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
Wish you could turn the clock back. Go to bigger function.
Yeah. By the way, your comment about, I wish I had known this before, I was exposed to this material just a few years ago, and I remember when I heard it, I thought, oh, I wish I had known this. You know, it would have saved me so much grief. I mean, I just had anguish of soul in this one situation that I described earlier about a person who was highly political. And, you know, it was a heavy, heavy burden for 2 years. You know, and I wrote to the person and said, you know, please, can we be reconciled? And, you know, I really want to be. And the person said, sorry, we just don't see eye to eye. We just have to recognize we're not on the same page. You know, see ya, let's don't talk to each other anymore. Well, it just broke my heart, you know. But I realize now, had I understood this, there might have been a chance. The other man was very godly, you know. I mean, he still is, you know. Right.
Crept in.
Sure.
And then it was still resolved. But it just, mm-hmm. I thought there must be something sinful somewhere, uh-huh. and there wasn't. And I pursued that line. And
yeah. By the way, there's some huge interesting dynamics for this in marriage too. Mm-hmm. If you have a marital partner who operates in a different frame, mm-hmm. like me.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that? Because naturally, any one of us fits in one of those frames, plus additionally, you know. Do you think that everybody could be a leader in its own framework? I mean, effective leader.
I think, I do believe, again, God sovereignly designates leaders, but there are all kinds of levels of leadership. And again, if leadership is influence, primarily, people following, then everybody could be a person of influence. So the question then is, what is the appropriate context in which to exercise your influence? And that may be in a large structure, you know, mm-hmm. with hundreds of people or so on, or it may be in a fairly small setting. And again, I might do very well as a leader in a certain kind of setting, under a certain set of dynamics that correspond to my default frame. But it might be very unwise for me to go try to operate in another setting. And of course, again, this is a set of tools you can use to analyze whether you really fit in a situation that you have an opportunity to serve in. Suppose, as a pastor, you know, you're being called by a church to serve them, and you spend a half an hour with the elders and you figure out, this doesn't fit my frame. We're just going to constantly having to mm-hmm. accommodate one another.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think that the scale determines that the certain frames are going into the hierarchy? The scale, for example, you know, mm-hmm. 10 people, you know, 50 people, 200 people, 2,000 people. Does it mean that it will determine that at the top will be the structural one, uh-huh. In the middle one, yeah. you know, there's possibility structural plus mm-hmm. eventually yeah. another frame.
That's a great question.
Isn't determinative factor scale?
That's a great question. The authors say that presidents tend to be symbolic. People that found organizations, that start organizations, or that lead organizations tend to be highly symbolic. I don't know, but the answer is, I think you're onto something there, but I don't know. I do think that that in the American context, people that rise to positions of significant responsibility probably have fairly high structural gifting, because American organizations tend to be structural, as their organizational culture tends to be structural. We all know about Willow Creek Church. You know, Willow Creek Church, the people that do well there are structural people. Now, Bill Hybels is himself symbolic and structural. He's highly symbolic. But also, there are other cultures where that would never work. You know, again, in Brazil, I can't imagine a person being an effective leader in Brazil that didn't have very high human resources.
Even in a large scale?
My guess is they'd have to have some combination that included human resource.
Okay.
My guess. But I don't understand Brazilian culture well enough to know. I think that is an excellent question. I'd love to talk to you 10 years from now after you've had a chance to observe and think about this. When you write your book on the subject, I'm going to read it. Okay.
It seems to be the case that people who start Christian organizations are not the people who carry them forward.
Correct.
Yeah.
And in fact, people who recognize that the gifts to start an organization are not the same gifts to sustain it, and have the discipline and humility to turn it over and move on, are to be greatly admired. Basically, I've seen people sort of build a monument to themselves, you know.
You said just quickly on the finishing, but something, a problem like a midweek meeting, you can quite quickly think, you can tell us what you think yourself, work out as a frame, what's going on, what's political, etc. But when you've got deeper issues, it seems to me it's going to take time to sit and listen to what people are. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
There's an element of really sitting and listening to people.
Yeah. But again, if I can listen to somebody and understanding that they're speaking a different language from me, and I can learn to develop some proficiency in that language that's not my native language, so to speak, then the chances of me listening really well and effectively are much higher.
Yeah.
You know, you could talk to me all day in Polish, and I could be sincerely trying to listen to you, but my ability to understand you would be extremely limited.
So if you start a new team, organization, you really want to spend a lot of time not doing a lot, so to speak, in the sense of spending time listening to each other.
Say, what language do you speak, and how can I learn your language? Teach me your language.
Sorry?
Yes.
Yeah. We're talking for, let's get on with it.
Yeah.
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 That's helpful.
I
think this has been very beneficial, but I want to also remind you, it's 2010 now.
Yeah.
And you'll have conversation at your dinner table too. So.
Thank you, Gretchen.
More profitable than this one. Ralph, I think that the framework in which we are functioning determines our reading the Bible as well.
Oh, you really are thinking deeply about this, aren't you? I think you're right.
You cannot escape from the impression and disappointing the leaders and so on. From my framework, I cannot escape the impression that the relationships are the most important thing, and the humility and cooperation are determinative factors.
Right.
So for me, leaders are not important at all, and I don't see them, in the Bible even.
Right.
Oh, I see them, but hardly.
Right.
I see other teamworks.
Right. Well, the Bible certainly says more about following than leading. Yeah.
Because of my framework.
Right. Right. Well, I think you're right.
Texts, the stresses, the emphasis are different.
Yes.
For you and for me, for you, for her.
That's right. Yeah, I think the Bible doesn't use the word leader very often. The word leadership doesn't appear very much in the Bible, and when it does, it's usually a military term. The metaphors in the Bible for people who carry out leadership functions are servant, steward, and shepherd. Mm-hmm. So the Bible has a lot more to say about following and serving than it does about leading, in the sense that we mean leading when we use the word. You're absolutely right. And of course, when I'm talking about leading, I'm talking about the function of a person, not the way they conduct it.
Yeah. Course,
yeah. So this is very good. I'm going to.
Thank you
very
much.
Well, it was. Oh, thank you. Thank you. This was great to just be able to sit here and talk about this.
Yeah.